You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Derek Jeter, Mariano Rivera, Andy Pettit, and Jorge Posada made up the Core Four, a group of New York Yankee players central to the team's most recent dynasty. Mr. Posada spent his entire 17-year career with the Yankees, won 5 World Series rings along the way, and was a leader both on the diamond and in the clubhouse. In The Journey Home, My Life in Pinstripes, a memoir he wrote with the help of Gary Brozek, Mr. Posada reflects on the rigorous work ethic instilled in him by his father, which helped him recover from a devastating injury in the minor leagues, and on the close personal relationships he developed during a career as one of the greatest Yankee catchers of all time. I'm very pleased to welcome Jorge Posada to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. You retired after the 2011 season, so you've had time to reflect on your personal and team achievements in baseball. What are some of the bigger themes that come to mind when you look back at your career?
Well, I think the championships, you know, every one of them are very, very unique, very different. So they're like kind of your go-to things, because you accomplish what you want to accomplish. You get to spring training and the things that you practice and work for is to win a world championships.
Although I don't see you wearing any of those rings.
I don't, yeah. I'm hiding them in a bank somewhere.
4 of those World Series championships came in your first 5 years with the Yankees. Does success of that sort ever go to a team's head? Do you think the championships just will keep on coming?
You know what? They feel good, and you're prepared, and you know that, you know, the team that you have a chance the next year, especially if the nucleus of the team stays together. And that's what happened. You know, we stayed together for a pretty long time. And, you know, you go back and you see the core four, and you put Bernie Williams in there, the Paul O'Neills, and, you know, the guys that were a constant on the field. And it's good to, you know, to have that push and have everybody going in the same way, same direction. I think that's what we had.
Your father has played a very big role in your life. Wasn't he a pretty good athlete in his own?
He was a good athlete. He a good swimmer, you know, national championship in Cuba, a cyclist, you know, track star, and, you know, he did a lot of basketball, even played basketball against Fidel Castro before, obviously, who, you know, he became who Fidel was. But you know, he stayed in Cuba. He signed to play with the Philadelphia Athletics back then, and you know, he got denied because Castro took over.
You write that he had a before and after scrapbook of his accomplishments. The divider being when Castro came to power. So he escaped with the family?
Yeah, not the family. He was the only guy that stayed in Cuba because he was useful for the, you know, for the government, or, you know, the regime or whatever. He had 4 sisters. He was the only one that was useful because he was a male, and had in between the years of 18 and 30, I think it was 32. That if you were during that time a male during these years, you were, you know, useful for the government back then.
How did you wind up in Puerto Rico then?
My dad, he escaped from Cuba with a tobacco cigar chip that was going to Greece. He got inside the chip, and, you know, once he felt like the ship was gone for, like, you know, a couple of hours, he went outside, and they told him that he was going to get arrested and stuff like that, because he, you know, he wasn't supposed to be there. So when they were going to turn the boat around, but they called the authorities, and they said, no, just keep going to Greece. Once you're in Greece, we'll get him there. But they just grabbed him. They didn't handcuff him on anything, just grabbed him by the hands. So he just, you know, let go, and he's still running. He remembers that. He was still in great shape, and, you know, at 24, I know he was 27 years old when this happened, so he was in great shape, and he said, there's no way that these guys are going to catch me.
He became a scout for the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah, he was with the Blue Jays for 10 years, Atlanta Braves for almost 13, and Colorado Rockies for 7, and now he's with the San Francisco Giants.
What role did he play in your development as a baseball player?
Well, he did a lot of things that I didn't know what what the hell was going on. Why was he making me do this stuff? Stuff like, you know, paint the house, take care of the iron fences and stuff like that. And even drove a truck full of dirt in front of the house to make the field behind the house level. Things that I'm like, why? And then, you know, later on, obviously, when I'm older, I realized that he was making me be a little bit disciplined, hard work, and no excuses. Don't ask why.
But then he also gave you drills to make you a ball player. Didn't he want you to become a switch hitter?
Yeah, when I was when I was 11 years old, he said you're gonna hit right-handed when you face a left-handed pitcher, and you're gonna hit left-handed when you're facing a right-handed pitcher. We've been practicing, but I didn't think I was gonna be, you know, facing pitchers and hitting left-handed. I also didn't understand why, you know, back then he was trying to make me do it, but you know, he had a plan, and I was his project.
Did he want you to live out his dream of becoming a major leaguer?
Yeah,
sometimes that could be oppressive on a kid.
Yeah, you know what? But I love the game so much that everything he made me do, I did, and I didn't ask why. You know, I know he was trying to make me better, and you know, even though when I was getting older and older, I can see why he was doing the things that he was doing. And I'll tell you, switch hitting made me, you know, a great ball player.
Well, not everyone can adjust to being a good switch hitter.
Yeah.
So were there special things that you developed? Do you think you were ambidextrous to begin with?
No. I think for sure I'm right-handed all the way. The only thing I do left-handed is hit a baseball. You know, there's a lot of work, a lot of practice, a lot of, you know, a lot of failure, a lot of, you know. But once I got it, once I got used to being on that side of the plate, a lot of things, a lot of positive things started coming.
After you played American Legion ball, you played for a team your father put together.
Yeah.
And then you played at a junior college in Alabama. Were you already being scouted by major league teams?
Yeah, I got drafted after high school, and I didn't sign because I got drafted super low, and I still wanted to, you know, get more experience. I wasn't ready. You know, if I would have signed then, I don't think I would have been here talking to you. So I went to a two-year school, and I wanted to go to a four-year school, but my SAT numbers weren't good. My English wasn't good. So I went to a two-year junior college. We were talking in the Miami area, Florida, and the Alabama coach called the right time at the right place. I said, I didn't even know where Alabama was when he called. And so he said, no, just above Florida. I wanted to be, you know, in the south because I didn't want to be in the cold weather. But he called.
That's why you wound up with the Yankees.
Yeah. But, yeah, he called at the right time. And, you know, I said, yeah, I'm coming. You know, he gave me a full ride.
And then you got drafted a second time, but that was also pretty low,
yeah.
The 24th round.
Yeah.
Had you expected to be drafted higher?
I don't know. You know what? I didn't think I was going to get drafted by the Yankees again, and they draft me, so they saw something in me. I didn't sign right away. I signed to go to University of Alabama to keep going with studies, and since I did that, I think the Yankees saw that I was a pretty good student, that I was, you know, keep going. The Yankees offered me, before the other draft, a good amount of money, and that made me a player.
And you were playing in the infield at the
time?
Yeah,
I was an infielder, so second shortstop, third base.
When did you make the move to catcher?
After my second year of professional baseball. My first year I played second base. My second year I played all over the place. I caught a little bit. But then after that, they wanted me to be a full-time catcher, and it wasn't pretty at the beginning.
Well, catching, you really have to know things that the other players don't have to even think about.
Yeah.
I mean, beyond working with the pitcher, you're kind of like the field general, aren't
you?
Is that why
like
so many managers have been catchers?
Yeah, you're managing the game on the field. You're kind of like the quarterback in a football field. You know, their plays go through you. You call in the game. There's, you know, you see how the defense is played, and you call the game accordingly. Obviously, you go through a scouting report to try to, you know, how are you going to attack hitters. And you also have the you know, every day is a different pitcher. So you have to get used to, you know, what's this guy's power, what is his bread and butter, you know, what is his best pitch, and you know, you have to get to know everybody. So it's a lot of things that you do, and you kind of manage the game on the field.
My guest is Jorge Posada, who's written with the help of Gary Brzezik, The Journey Home, My Life in Pinstripes. When you were playing AAA ball with the Yankee Farm Club in Columbus, Ohio, you suffered a bad injury after a collision at home plate.
Yeah, I broke my ankle in a plate at the plate. It was so ugly that maybe I was going to be done. My career was going to be over. It was kind of that situation. Kind of like Buster Posey, what he went through, you know, broke it in many places and dislocated all the joints and tendons in the ankle. And it was just one of those things that you hope that the surgery and the work that you're going to put in, the rehab, is going to make it. But it took me almost a year to feel 100%.
And then I would have assumed you would have said, I'm going to play third base.
Well, at the beginning, I didn't want to catch anymore. I even told the manager, Stump Merrill, that I was done, that I didn't want to play catcher anymore. But then after a while, I forgot about that. You know, it was a heat in the moment kind of thing. And I think the best thing that happened, it was the work that I was doing, and it made me be a little bit more patient with myself and not be so strong, hard-headed.
You write about the first time you saw Derek Jeter. What were your first impressions of him?
Super skinny guy. I was, you know, like you said, hating a little bit when I first saw him because he was the first pick. Everybody was talking about the first pick. He's coming towards our minor league team, but he impressed me right away. You know, he made a plate in the hole, made a plate over the second baseman, and hit a home run that day. So I was like, shut up.
And then the two of you were called up from AAA at the same time in 1995, was it? What qualities did he have that made him so successful and able to live under the microscope of the New York media for all those years? Did he have that from the start?
From the get-go. Very smart man. A guy that would look at every scenario. Obviously look at the positives. There's no excuses with Derek, you know, and the things that he's able to do on the field, he talked because he played. And, you know, there was times that he wasn't 100% a lot of the times, but he wasn't injured. He was hurt, and he played hurt a lot, and that says a lot about a leader.
What about you? A lot of players don't want to come to New York. They'd prefer to play in smaller towns, yeah, because the press isn't as invasive. Did you feel that?
You know what? I only knew New York. You know, we were trained in the minor leagues. We were brainwashed in the minor leagues. We were taught the Yankee way from day one, how to conduct yourself. Yankees win. There's no second. There's always winning. We want to win that way all the time.
But then there was George Steinbrenner, who said if you don't, if you have a bad day, you might be traded.
Yes, that's the way it was. But you know what? We enjoy that. I think he made us a better team. He made us a better players. I think you put that uniform on and a lot of good things happen.
At the end of spring training in 1996, Joe Torre, the Yankees manager, broke the news that you were being sent back down to the minor leagues. Had you expected to stay?
Yeah, I thought I had a good spring. I thought, I was at least a chance to make the club. But the thing that Joe told me was that he wanted me to play. He didn't want me to sit on the bench. He wanted me to develop a little bit more. The injury in 94. And just wanted me to get more at-bats.
And what did Jeter say to you when you were sent down?
He wasn't, Jeter always was positive. He took it hard, you know, also. But, he knew that I was going to be up there soon. So we worked hard and get back on. I had a pretty good start of 96, and I was called up and down a lot that year.
We have to take a little break. Great. When we come back, we'll talk about what happened after you came back and about some of the people you played with. what it was like to play with somebody like El Duque, who had also come here on a boat. Did he sneak onto a boat?
Yeah, he got off Coast Guards. Yeah, like he was in the middle of the ocean with his family.
A lot of other people you mentioned: Bernie Williams, Paul O'Neill, but also David Wells, Pedro Martinez, Daryl Strawberry, Andy Pettit, David Cohn, who everybody seems to love. I don't know if you love him, but everybody else does. Maybe some of the people you played against, like Curt Schilling, and then again, Pedro Martinez. Jorge Posada, his book, The Journey Home, My Life in Pinstripes, it is published by Day Street, which is an imprint of William Morrow, and we will continue after this. And as I said, my guest is Jorge Posada, who's written The Journey Home, My Life in Pinstripes, with the help of Gary Brzek. It is published by Day Street, D-E-Y Street, which is a division of William Morrow. And so you came up to the Yanks, this time to stay. The Yanks were, divisionally, was down to 4 games from an 11-game lead that they'd had in late July. What did you learn about Joe Torre's approach as a manager?
He was calm, you know, even when we're, not playing well, or he was always the same. So he never, it didn't look like he was panicking, you know, and I think that peaceful look helped everybody. You know, he's okay, so I guess we are okay, you know, so he was kind of really helpful for the guys.
He'd been a catcher. Did he give you any tips?
No question. You know, he always wanted me to have a purpose behind every pitch that I call.
Who was the regular catcher at the time?
Girardi.
So he got most of the work at that time, and you were breaking in. Out of the great pitchers that you played with over the years, you write that Roger Clemens was your favorite to catch.
Yeah.
Why?
He was intense, you know, and he brought the best out of me, and I looked forward to catching him because I knew he was going to be a very good game, and I knew he was going to be on, and he brought a lot of enthusiasm into the game.
He had 354 career wins, won 7 Cy Young Awards, and yet he may never make it into the Hall of Fame. And you've said that players who have used performance enhancement drugs shouldn't be admitted into the Hall of Fame. Yeah. That includes a number of your teammates, not just Roger Clemens, Alex Rodriguez, Andy Pettit. Was all of that talk a distraction?
I didn't see it in front of me. You know, I got to know that they were, you know, doing this afterwards. You know, thank God that we had a clubhouse that was pretty private, and we never saw, you know, people talking about it or people even doing it or anything. So thank God for that, because I really don't. You know, that's so negative in the past that you want to keep thinking positive, and the things that help you win ball games is what is important here.
But you feel that the PEDs changed the game? Weren't people taking all sorts of drugs even in the old days?
Yeah.
A lot of people took speed or other drugs to keep them.
Yeah, it all depends on the era, you know, and unfortunately we had the PEDs in late 90s and
were they available in the clubhouse?
No.
Because in some teams they were.
No, not in our dugout.
I'd like to throw out some names of players, both teammates and competitors, and maybe you can tell us a little about what you thought of them. Bernie Williams?
Bernie Williams was the guy, a great player, a switch hitter, a guy from Puerto Rico that I follow and emulate a lot. A guy that opened the doors for everybody else, for the minor leaguers.
Did he sing in the clubhouse?
He played. Mm-hmm. He's not a singer. He plays his guitar a lot.
And then Paul O'Neill, didn't talk much.
A fighter, an intense player, a winner. That's why they call him the Warrior.
What about Orlando Hernandez?
Orlando Hernandez is probably the smartest, one of the smartest pitchers I got to catch. Feisty, smart on the mound. Didn't know the league, you know, in 1997, and he really helped us to win 98.
Two other smart pitchers, Pedro Martinez, Curt Schilling.
Yeah, no question. Pedro Martinez is probably the toughest pitcher to face.
But you didn't like him.
No, you know, I don't think any Yankee liked him.
Well, is it a matter of the other guy is beating you all the time, or
well,
is it
yeah,
also attitude? Because sometimes I remember when the Mets were called arrogant.
Yeah.
And you played with a couple of those guys. In fact, Daryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden and David Cohn.
Yeah.
They were called arrogant, and teams didn't like them simply because they had that swagger.
Well, you have a swagger when you're good, you know, when you win. You know, we had that swagger when we played. You know, the Yankees did. So I think it's just a matter of you can't, you know, you just can't take matters into your own hand.
Were you aware of Daryl Strawberry's drug problems?
Yeah. Yeah, we knew about it when he came over. Obviously, he was getting a second chance by Stan Brenner, and he was a hell of a teammate.
Mm-hmm. And also Dwight Gooden.
Yeah, great. I mean,
You had so many good ex-Mets on David Cohn.
Yeah, David Cohn. I was intimidated a little bit by David Cohn. Fierce competitor on the mound, big game pitcher.
You were afraid of him?
I was intimidated by him. He was very intense. I wasn't afraid. I thought him being a veteran, me being a rookie, I was a little bit intimidated by him, yeah.
A key to the success of any sports team, the players who know their jobs and are able to execute their part of the overall game plan and help the team win games. What teammates come to mind for you who played an important part in the Yankees' success and that the media may have missed?
Well, you go with the locks and stuff like that, but you're talking about fit-ins that, you know, Tino Martinez, you know, guys like, you know, you're talking about Mariano and Derek, obviously, but, you know, there's also pieces, you know, you're talking about Chuck Knoblauch was a big piece of the lineup. Scott Brosius was, you know, you're talking about a Gold Glove third baseman and a Gold Glove first baseman in Tino Martinez. These are special key ingredients into that team.
You write that the Yankees' playoff losses in 2010 and 2011 were partly because the clubhouse wasn't as loose as it was in 2009. But there were some players who thought the Yankee clubhouse had been too loose. CC Sabathia.
Yeah, there were. It wasn't about being loose, or it wasn't. It was more about the focus was not the same. I thought that we lost a little bit of our edge, of our focus in 2010 when we really, really had it in 2009.
Much has been made about what you had to say about in the book about the 2011 season, the last of your career, and how you felt about being pulled from the lineup by Joe Girardi. Now, did it feel odd to be coached and then managed by someone who you had competed with as a catcher when you were breaking in?
No, me and Joe had a great relationship, you know, as teammates. I think things changed a little bit. And I think for his, you know, I think he wanted to, you know, be the coach and kind of have that, you know, separation between coaches, and that's what happened. I lost the communication, and I think I have a lot to blame for. And, you know, I feel like if I go back, I probably will communicate a little bit more with him, and I didn't do that. And, you know, there was a lot of things that I regret dearly, like pulling myself out of the game, you know, in that game. But you know what? Things happen, and you learn from them, and you keep going.
You pulled yourself out of the game because you've been placed last in the batting order.
Yeah, because
can happen in the American League because the DH, the pitcher doesn't pitch last, bat last.
Yeah, the thing is just like miscommunication or, you know, he said that he was going to move the lineup around and he only moved, you know, two players, moved me bat ninth and the things that, there was a lot of things going on before that, just was the turning point for me.
Although batting ninth still means it could be important. In fact, often,
no question,
there's a regret that guy who comes up ninth with runners on base is a bad hitter.
Yeah, you know what? I was struggling. You know, I was struggling, and
you were 39 years old at the time.
Yes, sir. I was struggling. I was hurt, and I wasn't hitting good. And you know, I was fine with the move. I wasn't fine with the words he used in the lineup he moved.
Well, you say in the book, I'll put this as plainly as I can. When you take me out from behind the plate, you're taking away my heart and my passion. I know that my role with the club was changing, but I don't think that anyone making those decisions knew how much the things being done hurt me.
Yeah.
Who was replacing you as catcher?
A great catcher, Russell Martin.
So
I knew I couldn't catch. Every day, you know, I knew I couldn't catch every day. That's why they did a move and got Russell Martin, a better catcher, you know, at that time than me, and that's fine. But I could have helped as a catcher. Whenever Russell needed a day off, I could have been that guy, and I wasn't.
There's also the matter. Some players complain that when they're a DH, the fact that they're not out in the field, they're not really engaged in the game in the same way.
Yeah.
Whether you're in the outfield or you're behind the plate.
When you know how to DH and how to prepare, how to catch, and you prepare as a catcher, when you are a DH, you feel out of the way. You kind of like, you know, you're not part. It doesn't feel like you're part of the game.
Now, Girardi, as we mentioned, is another form of catcher. So Joe Torre, and there have been any number of others. And we said earlier that catchers probably know more about what's going on than other position players. So with that in mind, would you want to manage?
No. I really don't.
Not even in the minor leagues or coach?
No, I don't want to be away from home. I like being home. I like, you know, not having a schedule. If anything I would do with baseball, it would be kind of like, you know, putting a team together or trying to help out a prospect to come up to the big leagues or something like that. In that sense, I don't want to be in uniforms.
Well, you, with the minor leagues and then the majors, you were pretty much traveling around for almost 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years.
And that really makes it rough on a home life.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's not fair for the kids, and it's not fair, obviously, for my wife, Laura, to, you know, not have me there, and the kids are growing, and I'm not there.
And then you have your son, Jorge Luis, was diagnosed with a congenital birth defect called craniosynostosis that required several surgeries to correct. Could you be around for all of that?
I didn't. I mean, I was there for the operations. I wasn't there for the whole time. The struggle that my wife went through, I mean, we went through, leading into operations. Jorge went through 9 skull surgeries.
What is the condition?
It's when the bones are fused together before the brain grows. So if they're together, the brain doesn't grow normally. So they had to go in and open that space, and he had 9 operations like this.
How's he doing now?
He's doing great. He's 15 years old, smart, loves sports, plays baseball on varsity team in his school. Health is, you know, all well with him.
There's always a problem when a kid plays the same sport that his father played or his mother played because they're always going to be compared.
Yeah.
Once in a while, they turn out to be great, but often it's a real problem for them.
Yeah, that's the first thing I tell him. I don't want him to play baseball because I played baseball. I want him to play baseball because I want him to love the game the way I loved it. If he does, I ask him all the time. I said, you enjoying yourself? I say, yeah, I'm enjoying it. You want to practice? You want to go? And he says yes all the time. So, you know, he enjoys it and he likes it.
How you make him into a switch hitter?
He is actually a left-hander thrower, a right-hander hitter. So he's a little backwards than me.
15 years ago, you established the Jorge Posada Foundation, which deals with craniosynostosis.
Yeah. Yeah, we thank God we have merged with MyFace. MyFace does all, not only craniosynostosis, they do all kind of craniofacial surgery. So we're really, really enjoying the merge.
Did it affect the team when George Steinbrenner passed away?
You know what? I think the the kids, the Steinbrenner family, have done a hell of a job. We missed George dearly, though. You know, he was great, and
not all the players felt that way.
We loved him. We loved him. There was nothing I can say. He was the first one with a check every year for my foundation. He was always there for me with Jorge. I cannot say enough about Mr. Steinbrenner.
Well, other people, Reggie Jackson, Billy Martin, probably wouldn't have said the same kinds of things.
If you ask Reggie Jackson the same question, he's going to tell you that he loves Steinbrenner dearly.
Really?
Yeah.
So now that you're out of baseball, I'm assuming you still follow what's going on. Do you go to games?
I go every once in a while. I go when there's a big event. Obviously, I'm going to be there May 24th. Bernie Williams is getting his number retired. So I'll be there. And different events, you know, throughout the season. I was there last year for Derek's last game at home. And I enjoy watching the Yankees. I mean, that's home for me. That's my love.
Well, you were never traded. I've always wondered about players who were traded and then, if they are lucky enough to be selected for the Hall of Fame, then they have to decide what team they want to be selected as being a member of.
Yeah, you pick, I guess you choose what hat you want the plaque.
You just retired, living off of the millions of dollars that you made as a player?
Yes, I'm retired, and I'm enjoying every minute of it.
And you don't miss baseball?
I miss it. You know, I miss my friends. I miss my family in the game, that, you know, my brothers. But you know what? You get used to it. You find different things. And, you know, the kids have been great because they have different Jorge doing baseball. My daughter Paulina does volleyball and softball, so we're very busy with them.
It's interesting that so often that whole families wind up being sports-minded while other families are not. I guess this is the legacy of your father. What about your mother?
My mother didn't play any sports. She was more of making me the humble person that I am today.
I've always wondered about what it's like for a catcher when a pitcher suddenly goes wild, for mm-hmm. example, or when he's called for a curveball and in comes a fastball, yeah. Vice versa. I'm sure you went through all sorts of different things of that sort. Is this a matter of just going up to the pitcher and saying, hey, wait a minute, you got to settle down?
There's a lot of signs going on right now. You know, when there's a guy at second base, there's different signs thrown down, so the guy at second base is not telling the hitter what's coming. But right now, you know, with the TVs and the technology, there's different signs thrown down, and you know, the pitcher.
You have the sportscaster saying, oh, a curveball inside. That's what he's going to pitch now.
Yeah, they pretty much know. So there's different signs going on a lot because of technology now. And, you know, here soon, you know, we're probably going to see, you know, a little bit more than that. And the pitcher and the catcher have to be on the same page.
And what was it like to catch Mariano Rivera's cutter?
It was easy.
Really?
Yeah, because you know it's coming. And he was so good at it.
But batters knew it was coming, too, and they still didn't hit it.
He was amazing. I mean, there was no word to describe this guy. He was unbelievable at what he did.
Jorge Posada will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Bookmark Shop. That's at 3rd Avenue in Brooklyn. And then he'll speak and sign books tomorrow at 4:30 at Books and Greetings, is it, in Northvale, New Jersey. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, The Journey Home, My Life in Pinstripes, written with the help of Gary Brozek and published by Day Street, D-E-Y Street, which is an imprint of William Morrow. Thank you so much for being on our show. It's
no
been
problem.
A great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, we should point out that there are lots of pictures.
There's
well.
A couple pictures of me growing up, too, so they were kind of unique.